Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2014 Home Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Good morning. It is good to be here with you. I grew up near the sunny, sandy coastline of Southern California, which is why my husband gave me a hard time when we first moved back east and we went to the beach for the first time. It was late in the afternoon, and I said, hurry, let's get to the beach. I want to watch the sunset. But I got to spend a lot of time building sandcastles, which I love to do. But we had to build them down by the water because that kept the sand holding together. But that also meant that when the first big wave of the high tide came in, my sandcastles always washed away. None of them ever were standing when we left the beach for the day. Sandcastles come to my mind when I think about what I remember learning in school. I can only remember a handful of state capitals, the little moles of my high school chemistry class that I couldn't wrap my mind around then have reverted back to the blind little furry creatures that live in the ground. Even though I scored in the 99.9th percentile in a national math competition, I can no longer plot X or Y on anything. I doubt that I could pick the quadratic equation out of a lineup, and I don't, for the life of me, know what it's for. I remember in 10th grade, I missed the meiosis-mitosis question because I always got those mixed up, but you know, it's been 40 years since then, and not once in all that time has that question ever come up again. And, you know, when I think about the high school or all the college exams that I stayed up all night studying for, if I had to retake any of them today, I doubt that I would pass them. I've read studies where they've estimated that the average person will lose 90% of the information they learn in school. Now, I don't know if that's accurate, but I've done my own little informal research among family and friends, and I get the same response as I just told you, that, you know, what do you remember? Not much, unless it was a subject that they loved, or if it was a subject they continued to use in their lives, or if you had one of those rare photographic memories where you held on to everything. So you might ask, did I remember anything from my school days? And the answer is actually yes. I remember my eighth grade graduation dance because I had a crush on Dan Reed. I remember that he was late to math class one day because he'd been out shooting a TV commercial. That's how cool he was. I, on the other hand, was a geek. I stood a head taller than all the other girls in my class. I had glasses and braces, and as if I wasn't awkward enough, my mother had hand-sewn me a pink, pale pink graduation dress to wear to the dance. In an age of miniskirts, she wanted me to be modest. And so my dress had a little light white lace scallop that fell very modestly below my knees. And so there I was at the dance, hugging the walls, watching everybody out on the floor dance, and especially watching Dan Reed dance. And then I noticed that Dan Reed was looking at me. And I looked around to see who else might be there, but it was just me. And then he started walking towards me. My heart started to race as he walked right up to me, held out his hand, smiling, looking me in the eye, said, "Marlene, would you like to dance?" Of course, I was too terrified to actually say yes, and I made up some lame excuse, but inside, I was dancing on air, and that memory remains as clear and bright and detailed as if it had happened yesterday. Overall, the things I remember from school are the feelings, the disappointments, the embarrassments, and the impressions that went into my heart, not what went into my mind. I got straight A's in school. I must have had the information at some point. But so much of that is washed away, just like my sandcastles. My school days were filled with information. The fact that I cannot tell you the difference between meiosis or mitosis is of no consequence to the world at all. But we're living in a different day. Today, the buzzwords are high order and critical thinking skills. We administer SAT reasoning tests to our students so they can demonstrate their proficiency in rejecting all beliefs that cannot be backed by hard evidence. We train kindergartners to rely on that which can be seen, touched, and measured. Emotional thinking is frowned upon. Scientific reasoning reigns supreme. which is why we're living in dangerous times. Hans Christian Andersen wrote a little story about 150 years ago warning us about this danger. Disney just made a movie, Frozen, based upon this story of the Snow Queen. But if you've read the story and watched the movie, you know they're not the same thing. So I think it's worth revisiting the story as Andersen told it for just a minute in context of what we're talking about. Long, long ago, there lived a hobgoblin, a demon, really, who one day made a mirror that had a particular power. Everything that was beautiful or good that was reflected in it was made to look bad and ugly. And everything that was bad and ugly was magnified, and every fault could be plainly seen. The scholars at his demon school carried this mirror all over the world until there wasn't a land or a people that had not been reflected in it. And then they thought it would be really funny if they carried it high up into the heavens and looked at the very faces of the angels in it. But the higher they flew, the slipperier the mirror became until it crashed to the earth and shattered into millions of pieces. Now the mirror caused even more problems and more unhappiness in the world, because if a little speck, even as tiny as a grain of sand, would get into the eye, it would have the property of the whole mirror, and you couldn't see anything rightly. And if a shard, even a tiny shard, got into the heart, it would start to turn the heart to ice. The pieces soon covered the whole earth, and the demon laughed so hard at the mischief that he created that he almost split his sides. Now, in a large town lived two poor little children named Kai and Gerda, who loved each other dearly. They often played under a little red rose bush that was between their two homes. And one day, just after noon, Kai cried out, "Oh, something has just pierced my heart, and it feels like there's something in my eye." Gerda was worried for her friend, and she started to cry. And he said, "Why are you crying? There's nothing wrong with me, and you look ugly when you cry. And what is that worm doing on that rose bush? And what an ugly little box growing in." And he kicked the box and broke the roses off and ran off to play with his friends. One day he was out. By and by he started to make fun of the townspeople. And all the townspeople thought that he was very clever and laughed. He now thought that the stories and picture books his mother, his grandmother told him were very stupid. One day he was out playing in a large field on his sleigh. And as he was playing, a large white sleigh pulled up, driven by a white figure in white robes. She circled the field. He was intrigued. He grabbed hold of the back of the sleigh, and all of a sudden, it took off. Faster and faster it went. He tried to let go, but he couldn't. He was afraid, and he tried to pray. But all he could remember were his multiplication tables. Finally, the sleigh stopped. And the figure stood up. She was tall and beautiful. She was the Snow Queen. She opened her warm coat for Kai to snuggle in. "Are you still cold?" she asked. Although his heart was now almost a lump of ice, he no longer felt cold or afraid. He thought the face of the Snow Queen was the most beautiful he had ever seen, that there was nothing more perfect. He proudly told her that he could do arithmetic clear up to fractions in his head. And he knew the total square miles and all the number of inhabitants that lived in the town. And the Snow Queen smiled. Off they flew again, over woods and lakes, over sea and land. And Kai felt perfectly safe. Meanwhile, little Gerda didn't believe what the townspeople told her, that Kai must have fallen into the river and drowned. So she set off in search for him. And after a very long and difficult journey, she finally arrived at the magnificent ice palace of the Snow Queen, where inside there were hundreds of vast, empty, cold rooms. And in the midst of this palace was a long hall that stretched for miles, and in the middle of that was a large frozen lake. And in the middle of the lake stood the Snow Queen. She called the lake the Mirror of Reason and said it was the best and indeed the only one in the world. When Gerda finally found little Kai, he was quite blue, almost black, with shivering. But he didn't feel it, for the Snow Queen had kissed away his icy shiverings. There he was, dragging sharp, flat pieces of ice to and fro, trying to get them to fit into different shapes. It was the icy game of reason, And everything he created in his eyes was very remarkable and of highest importance. But try though he may, he could not form the one word he desperately wanted to make. He wanted to form the word eternity, for the Snow Queen had told him that if he should ever discover that word, he would become the master of his own soul. She would give him the whole world and a new pair of skates. Gerda ran to him and threw her arms around his neck, but he sat cold and stiff. She started to cry, and her hot tears melted the ice shard in his heart. And then he started to cry, and it washed the speck out of his eye. He looked around. Gerda, where have you been? As he looked all about, he said, how vast and cold and empty it looked. The two friends danced around with tears of joy of being back together until they finally fell to the floor, wrapped in each other's arms. And as they lay there, finally, he formed the one word that he was looking for, eternity. And the power of the Snow Queen was broken forever. The two friends made their way back to their little house, now grown up, but still children at heart. And it was summer, warm, beautiful summer. I'm afraid that I see the influence of the Snow Queen all around us. That which is good and beautiful is made to look small and insignificant, even ridiculed, while that which is bad and ugly is magnified. When I read biographies that were written 100 years ago, they inspire my heart with goodness. Now we've knocked all of our heroes off their pedestals, and the modern biographers choose to focus on the flaws and the weaknesses. That which used to be good is now called evil, and that which is evil is now called good. Everything has been turned upside down. The comments in the comments section that I read are mean-spirited and cruel. Intellectuals mock feelings and demand scientific studies and factual evidence is the only grounds for discussion. If an idea cannot be measured or tested, it's rejected. Emotion is scorned. I love to go rummage through old books and find old children's books, and a lot of times I'll bring them home and read what people say about the books. And this is very common to find these kind of comments. I'll read a comment that will say, this book changed my life. I've read it so many times, my copy's falling apart. The pages of my book are covered with tears. I read the book 60 years ago and just reread it. I love it more today than I did then. And then I'll read comments about the same book written by young people today. And I'll see comments like, this is the most boring book I have ever read. I hated this book. No one should ever have to read it. It moved so slowly, I wanted to die. And this one, I hated all those feelings. This shift from heart to mind hasn't happened by accident or overnight. It's been by design and with steady effort. Many of the most influential men and women of the last century, especially those who have influenced education, have dreamed of a world governed by reason. Reason, they say, can solve all of our problems. Reason can dictate to us a moral code that works. And what reasonable person would ever think that war is reasonable? Their philosophy can be summed up in this simple phrase in a humanist manifesto. Reason and intelligence are the most effective instruments that humankind possesses. There is no substitute. Those sound like Snow Queen words, don't they? The experiment has gone on long enough for the results to come in, and the result is our world has turned upside down. It's a grave mistake to train the intellect of a child before we've tended to his heart. Much of the frustration of young kids today is because we are forcing them to do academic activities for which they are not developmentally ready. We ignore the fact that childhood has been reserved by our Creator for making impressions on the heart and for warming the heart. Children can feel before they can reason. But we've tasted the fruits of science and technology, and it tastes really good. We can hardly wait for science's next big reveal or technology's next gadget, newest gadget, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's all very exciting. We do want our children to develop scientific reasoning skills. We want scientists and engineers, but it needs to happen in its proper order. First, heart, and then mind. And the reason for that is clear. Science and technology in the hands of evil or foolish hearts can and will destroy us. Only in the hands of good and wise hearts will it bless our lives. Science is a wonderful servant, but a dangerous master. By abandoning making long-lasting impressions on the heart in favor of facts and information in childhood years, we've created a massive educational system of sandcastles. But it's not only our learning that we're having a hard time holding on to. Everything in our world is becoming slipperier. We're having a hard time holding on to our homes, our money, our jobs, our relationships, our faith, even our freedom. I blame the Snow Queen's hold on us. Only by paying proper attention to heart can we begin to put our world back into balance. For the amount of time, money, and worry that are going into educating our kids, I'm not satisfied with sandcastles, as fun as they are to build. I want diamonds. Diamonds are one of the few things in this world that don't decay or crumble over time. If I find a diamond that was buried in a treasure chest 1,000 years ago and pull it out today, it's going to sparkle just as much as it did when it was buried. Diamonds are forever. I want a forever system of education. I want learning that will last, which is why I am a big proponent of Common Core standards. I think it would be great if all 50 states adopted Common Core standards. In fact, I think the whole world would benefit from them. But the Common Core standards I have in mind are not the ones that are being breath of relief. Are not the ones that are being implemented in our schools today, because I have a different objective. Our schools hope to make our students college and career ready. They want global workers in the global economy. I think our kids deserve more than that. I think if we align our will to God's will, we're not going to go wrong. And it's God's will, man is, that he must have joy. So my objective is to prepare children to live lives of maximum joy. A job's going to be part of that journey, but it's not going to be the destination. My proposed Common Core standards don't need any governor's signatures. You don't need a committee to debate them. They require no federal funding. In fact, they don't require any funding at all. They're free to implement. And they can be implemented today in your home and in my home. These standards are the antidote to the Snow Queen's poison. I have them from high authority. The national standards say that they can explain theirs in 3 minutes. I can give you mine in just 3 words. Faith, 1, 2, hope, and 3, charity. Let me show you what they look like. First, faith. Faith is the first thing to go in a Snow Queen's reign because she demands full trust in only those things that can be seen, tested, and measured. Faith, on the other hand, requires us to trust in a higher force or power that usually can't be seen and asks us often to suspend reason. Reason would have had the children of Israel surrender to Pharaoh's army. What chance did they possibly have? Only faith would have suggested to them that they could part the Red Sea and cross over on dry ground. The world seeks truth by reason. God teaches, by the power of the Holy Ghost, you shall know the truth of all things. And he reveals that truth with a feeling, a burning in our hearts. We feel when something is right. In our day, we see men ever learning, but never coming to a knowledge of the truth. Truth, light, spirit, and living water are all words that are used interchangeably in the scriptures to describe what I call spiritual sunshine. And we all know what would happen to our world if the sun stopped shining. We need that spiritual sunshine, but it requires faith to believe in its existence. It can't be studied under a microscope, but you know when it's there because in its rays you feel joy, love, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, and meekness. It infuses joy into our souls and becomes part of us, which is what differentiates it from mere pleasure. Pleasure is usually temporal and temporary. The pleasure of eating a chocolate chip cookie only lasts as long as the cookie. Spiritual light, on the other hand, is satisfying and everlasting. All light can be traced back to a source, and the source of this light is Jesus Christ, who freely shines his light on everyone. What varies from person to person is our capacity to capture that light. Just like a diamond is valued by its capacity to capture light. Some diamonds will sparkle more than others. Spiritual inspiration quickens feelings. It animates us and makes us feel alive. It opens up our understanding. To be inspired literally means to take in breath, to take in spirit. Brahms relied upon this inspiration to compose his music. He described the process this way. I will now tell you about my method of communicating with the infinite. For all truly inspired ideas come from God. Beethoven, who was my ideal, was well aware of this. When I feel the urge, I begin by appealing directly to my maker. Straightway, the ideas flow in unto me, directly from God, and not only do I see distinct themes in my mind's eye, but they are clothed in the right forms, harmonies, and orchestrations. He went on to say this was the same power by which all the great composers like Mozart, Schubert, Bach, and Beethoven drew their inspirations. Elder Boyd K. Packer suggested that the greatest hymns will not come from the most highly trained among us. He said they will be produced by those who are the most inspired among us. Inspiration can come to those whose talents are barely adequate, and their contribution will be felt for generations. Orson Whitney said, we will yet have Miltons and Shakespeares of our own. God's ammunition is not exhausted. His brightest spirits are held in reserve for the latter times. But I can't see that happening until we begin to undo the damage of the Snow Queen and reopen the channels of inspiration to our children, which brings me to my Common Core standard for faith. Prepare the child's heart to be inspired. Goethe was asked how he kept spiritual light flowing inward, and his response was that every day he gazed upon a masterpiece of fine art, read a piece of fine literature, recited a selection of poetry, and listened to beautiful music, exactly the things the Snow Queen is eliminating from our classrooms. The Snow Queen may argue with me that the arts are still there, but what little of them are remaining is treated through intellectual and analytical eyes, not felt by the heart. The Snow Queen doesn't trust the heart. By filling the hearts of our children with beautiful images of art, literature, and poetry, we're giving the spirit something to light up. If I go out on a dark summer night and I shine a flashlight straight up into the sky, I don't see that beam of light unless it finds dust particles to reflect off of, or maybe a moth that flies by. If I want to see that light, I've got to shine it on the tree, the leaves, or the ground ahead of me, and then the light shines up. We can increase the light within our souls and the souls of our children by giving it a large surface area to light up, by following the admonition of Paul and treasuring up in our hearts those things that are virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy. We provide lots of surface area for the Spirit to light up. The Doctrine and Covenants tells us light cleaveth to light, and in that light will be felt great joy. When we block spiritual sunshine, the same thing happens as happens to a flower bed that's covered with a sun-blocking tarp. Everything underneath it begins to rot and decay. If we wish to prepare our children's hearts to be inspired, we need to give the Spirit room to do its job. Several months ago, I was looking for the Christmas stories to go in our Christmas volume, and one of the stories I found so affected me, so moved my heart, that I just sat at my desk and buried my face in my hands and wept. The feeling that this book gave me is that it made me want to be kinder. It made me want to be better. I could feel my soul enlarging. This book wasn't a literary masterpiece. There was no major conflict in it. There were even hints of political incorrectness in it. But still, it had such an effect on my soul. And I thought about, if I had read that book in school, I probably would have been asked to pinpoint character, setting, and plot. I may have been asked to search for and circle the use of literary devices, such as alliteration, or compare and contrast to the characters. I might have been required to identify and analyze what words the writer used to evoke emotion. And I'm sure I would have been given a long list of questions to answer. And in the process, it would have killed the spirit of the story. The letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. When heart work is going on, often silence is the best teaching method. The deeper a message is traveling into the heart, the fewer words there are to communicate what's going on. The ocean at its greatest depth is silent, and the Spirit communicates with the deeps of our souls. Allowing room for the Spirit to work is an important part of applying the Common Core standard of faith, preparing our children's hearts to be inspired. As we make room for the Spirit to work, we'll keep spiritual sunshine flowing in our world. Number two, hope. Hope has been the second casualty of the Snow Queen's reign. Hope is an expectation or desire of something better. It's what keeps us moving forward. Hope is dependent on vision. Without vision, the people perish. Nothing has ever been created or accomplished that did not first exist as an image or as a vision in someone's heart. In the excitement of filling our children's minds with facts and information, stories are being left behind, yet it's the stories that give vision to our hearts. Stories illustrate life. But we need to show our children all the possibilities of life. And for the most joyful life, we need to show our children what good looks like. The Snow Queen may tell us that being pure is old-fashioned or unreasonable, but it's the diamond of greatest purity that is of the most worth. The flawless diamond is practically incorruptible. The world's vision for our youth is not God's vision. His long-awaited kingdom is about to be established upon the earth. This is not the day for building sandcastles. We will see the day when Zion's sons and daughters, as famed for intelligence and culture as for purity, truth, and beauty, polished after the similitude of a palace, would entertain kings and nobles, yea, sit upon thrones themselves, or go forth like shafts of light from the bow of the Almighty as messengers and ambassadors to the nations. Most diamonds are formed under prolonged periods of high heat or intense pressure, a process that can be repeated to make the diamond harder. Diamond souls fit for the kingdom of God will be formed in the same way. One night, I was saying my usual prayer over my children, and I prayed, Heavenly Father, please watch over my children. Keep them safe from all accident and harm. Bless them with health and with strength and with every desire of their heart. But as I was praying, my prayer was gently interrupted with words that came into my mind. As he said, Marlene, are you asking me to deny them the very means that has brought you to come to know me? And I immediately knew that was right. It wasn't those times that everything was going right that I felt his spirit. It was when my back was to the wall, when I had no way out, when reason gave me no solutions to my problems. That's when I experienced his miracles and felt his spirit pouring into my soul. So I thought, it doesn't seem right to pray for horrible things to happen to my children. And so I said, I'm not sure what to pray for. And the sweet, gentle answer came immediately. Pray for more trust in me. That's a much harder prayer for me to pray, but I am trying. What we can do to keep hope alive in the hearts of our children through the troubling but necessary diamond formation stretches ahead is to make sure that we have filled their reservoir of stories with examples of others who have struggled through and overcome difficulties and challenges. We need to give them a vision of Zion to look forward to, and especially we need to show them what faith in God looks like. They need to know God always keeps his promises and that nothing is impossible to him. They'll know that through stories. Their heart will know that through stories. It will be the diamond souls with clear visions that will stand strong when the whole world is crumbling around them. They will be the ones that will inspire hope to those whose hearts are failing. By giving our children a vision of good things to hope for, which is my Common Core standard too, we will ensure there will be diamond souls who can withstand the heat and lift those around them to higher ground in the days ahead. Their hearts will not fail them. Number three, charity. Charity is the pure love of Christ, and love is the super glue of the universe. Take love out of a family and the family breaks up. Take love out of a marriage and the marriage falls apart. Take love of country away, patriotism, and the nation starts to crumble. Take away love of God and faith vanishes. Take the love of learning out of learning and learning doesn't stick. This pure love is a gift of spiritual sunshine. As the Snow Queen blocks access to this light, love grows colder. But by following Common Core Standard 1, prepare our children's hearts to be inspired, they will be inspired. And in the light of that spirit, the hearts of our children will be filled with pure love. It's not just enough to capture that light, though. They need to reflect the light outward. When a diamond is being valued, it's not just its capacity to capture light, it's in its capacity to reflect the light outward. In Robert Browning's Paracelsus, Festus and Paracelsus are lifelong friends. Paracelsus longs for the life of the scholar. He can imagine no greater joy than uninterrupted time alone with his books, poring over the great wisdom of the ages. This, he says, will be my great gift to mankind, to share with them all my vast knowledge and learning. 20 years later, the two friends meet up again. Paracelsus is a wreck. He's miserable, and he's dying. But he has finally learned the lesson, although too late for himself, as he now understands there is an answer to the passionate longings of the heart for fullness, and I knew it. And the answer is this: live in all things outside yourself by love, and you will have joy. This is the life of God. It ought to be our life. There's a right use and a right wrong use for everything. If you tweak the word righteousness just a little bit, you have right useness. The right use yields joy. The wrong use yields sorrow. This standard of right useness can be applied to business, money, education, music, art, the internet, sex, everything in our world. Great blessings in their right use and great misery in their misuse. Common Core Standard 3, teach the right use of all things in love. It's the formula for long-lasting joy. In the world's economy, the richest man is the one with the most money. In heaven's economy, the richest man is the one with the greatest capacity for joy. As love increases, joy increases. If we want our children to be heavenly rich, we need to show them what love looks like. Love suffereth long, is kind, envieth not, vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, does not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in truth. 10 years ago, the American Psychiatric Society revealed a study where they found that the average 18-year-old in the United States will have viewed over 16,000 violent deaths and over 200,000 acts of violence. I think I saw that many in the last movie trailer I saw. How many acts of love will we have given our children to view during those same formative years? How important is this love? One day I sent my husband to the store to buy me some broccoli for a casserole that I was making, and he came back a while later with his arms full of bags of groceries. He had bread and milk and cereal and cookies and chips and everything that was really good, but he hadn't brought the one thing home that I needed, the broccoli. Love is the broccoli of life. To paraphrase 1 Corinthians, though a child should score a perfect score on the SAT, graduate with honors from Harvard, write a New York Times bestseller, head up a major corporation, find the cure for cancer, or be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, if that child has not love, he shall be as sounding brass or tinkling cymbals. On the other hand, though a child speaks not three languages, fails algebra twice, cannot compare or contrast two characters in two major works of literature, never marries, lives out his life in a humble one-room cottage, and never does one single notable act in the eyes of the world, If that child's heart reflects love towards all God's creations, he will find his name in God's book of greatest treasures. He shall have discovered eternity and will be the master of his own soul. God is love. Now, I believe that Common Core standards should have frequent assessments. In fact, I think we should recommend a daily test administered to parents, and we can use the same three questions every day. Question one, today, what did I do to prepare my child's heart to be inspired? Question two, today, what vision of great things did I give my child to hope for? And question three, today, what did I teach the right use of in love? If we adopt these three Common Core standards, the outcome that we can expect is that we will see a new heart and a new world emerge in just a few years. Moroni saw us in our slippery world as he carefully chose the most important message he could leave us, a message that he thought was so important he repeated it twice in the last four chapters of the Book of Mormon. It's the formula that I've been describing for laying hold of every good thing. The formula is faith, hope, and charity. We live in extraordinary times. The prophets through the ages have looked upon our day with high anticipation. To use the words of Orson F. Whitney that he spoke 100 years ago, what shall I say to awaken in your hearts the desire to realize this glorious anticipation? I can only call upon God to make my words as sparks of fire to fall upon the tinder of your hearts and kindle them into flame, that from this hour your souls may be lit up with the light of your glorious destiny, that you may live for God and his kingdom, not simply for yourselves and the perishable things of the earth. Or in other words, to live for diamonds instead of the sandcastles. Do you remember the Magic Eye books that were popular a few years ago? They had these random designs on the pages, and if you stared at the design long enough and in just the right way, suddenly a 3D image would pop out of you. I had a Magic Eye moment with history not long ago, and that's the best way I can use to describe it. I had been reading the stories of the different nations, and I was sitting there studying a map of the world. And as I looked at each of the countries and thinking about the stories, it was as though in world's history, each nation had a chance to take center stage on the world stage, and the spotlight was put on them. And in that spotlight, they left a lesson to the world. So one nation would take center stage and the spotlight and lesson, then they would fade away into the background. And then another nation would take center stage, leave its lesson, and then fade away into the background. So I started thinking about what lessons I had learned from each of these nations. From ancient Greece, I learned about beauty. Ancient Rome, law and justice. China, respect for elders and honoring ancestors. France, equality and equal justice. Israel, the fatherhood of God. The Saracens, a love of learning. India, peaceful measures. Africa, I see a simple and pure faith emerging. Native Americans, reverence for nature. England, refinement through literature. Scotland and Ireland, liberty is worth dying for. You know, it was primarily the Irish and the Scotch who were among our early patriot fighters. Other nations left us painful lessons. They showed us the misery and suffering under the hands of tyranny and oppression. They taught us about the cruelty of greed and corruption when the nation's highest ideal is gold. And they displayed the savagery and barbarism, the rotten decay that set in when spiritual darkness sets in. Some people are offended at the thought of American exceptionalism. I am not. I say to the whole world, we are exceptional because we are your children. Admittedly, lately we've behaved as spoiled children always do, who are lavished with too many unearned gifts. But I say, please give us another chance. Let us turn our hearts back to you and to learn your stories and to learn the lessons for them. And then for the first time in human history, let us gather them into one whole. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. But there is one story, one lesson, one truth that has not been brought to center stage for the world to see. Maybe America has not yet had her chance to shine. Maybe this story is our story to show to the world. Interestingly, it's a story deeply embedded in the heart and spirit of the German people. And I was noticing this map, according to the 2000 census, that shows us that more Americans have German roots than any other nationality. The baby blue is German ancestry. This story was told by Wagner when he put the story to music, and it's told in part in the Nibelungenlied, which I want to briefly share. In the Rhine River, there lived three beautiful maidens, the Rhine daughters. Carelessly, one day, they lost the gold that had been entrusted to them by their father. They knew that whoever molded the gold into a ring would have all power over the earth, save love. The hideous little creature, Alberich, the Nibelung, who seized it, laughed wickedly. What do I care for love if I have all the gold in the world? Under his cruel power, the people cried out, that wretched Alberich with his ring of gold has made us all slaves. With it, he drives us down into the earth to get more gold. This curse of gold has filled our world with despair. The gold ring passed from one owner to another, causing misery, until it finally came into the hands of the noble and beautiful Brunhilde, who courageously returned it to the rightful owners, the Rhine daughters. At long last, gold no longer held power over the hearts of men. Hurry, worry, falsehood, greed, and envy vanished from the earth. Anxiety disappeared from the tired brows of the father. A new happiness came into the eyes of the mothers. A greater power than gold had come to rule the world. And that power was love. Ye are the hope of Israel. The heavens are watching and the earth is waiting for you. May we adopt a new common core standard if we will prepare the hearts of our children to be inspired, if we will give them a vision of good things to hope for, and if we will teach them the right use of all things in love, we will yet see the rising of that city shining upon the hill, seen and visioned by our pilgrim fathers and our ancient prophets. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising, saying, teach us your ways, that we may go home and teach our people. And righteousness will flood the earth, just as Isaiah prophesied. And our sons and daughters, and their sons and daughters, will be found singing songs of everlasting joy. Thank you.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.